Now, last week, we looked in chapters 8, 9, and 10, and we saw the manner in which the nation Israel transitioned from the theocracy of the judges into the theocracy of the kings. That period of the judges had lasted about 400 years or so, if we include Samuel's life in it. And if you recall, the way in which they transitioned from the theocracy being God working through these judges, which he would call individually from time to time as they were necessary, into this kingdom was basically the result of a world-class gripe on the part of the Israelites. They didn't like the fact that they didn't have a human king over them with a standing army to fight their battles and do all that sort of stuff, and so they complained and griped about that. And as Samuel was getting old, and it was obvious his sons were not the proper choice to transition into, they were worthless, they said, hey, we need a king. We want a king. We want to be like these other nations around about us. And in essence, they were saying to God, we don't like trusting you, God, to take care of us, to be our deliverer and our security. We want a man. We want a guy that we can turn to. And they griped about that long enough that God finally said, well, all right, I'll give you what you want, but you won't like it, because this guy is going to take from you to support the kingship. He's going to conscript your sons and daughters into government service. He's going to take your crops. He's going to take your animals. He's going to take your cash. He's going to take from you. And when you come back to me later on and cry out to me for help, because this guy is going to become just as abusive as these nations around us are, I'm not going to pay attention to you. You're going to rue the day that you ask for a king. But because you think you know what's best for you, I'm going to give that to you. And you'll wish I hadn't at a point in time. So he selected a guy that was obviously qualified, because he was tall, dark, and handsome. Clearly, a guy that's tall, dark, and handsome is qualified to be king of a nation, right? They thought so. What was his name? Yeah, Saul. What tribe was he from? Benjamites. What's the relative size of the Benjamites to the other tribes? Small list, wasn't it? And his family was even, he said, the least among them. But he looked good, so he was made king. And we'll see how things work out. They got what they asked for. And in chapter 10, he was actually coronated a couple of times. The first time was at Ramah, which was Samuel's hometown. Remember, he went out on that journey looking for the lost donkeys. Came back, crossed paths with Samuel, which was the purpose for the search to begin with. And Samuel anointed him privately in Ramah as king of Israel. Then later on, there was a second coronation at Mizpah, which is just another one of the little cities. You don't need to know exactly where it is down in Benjamite territories. But that was a second coronation that kind of got him up and going. And then that gets us up here to chapter 11, where we want to continue on here this morning. So he has been coronated, that is, Saul has been coronated king of Israel, once privately, once more publicly at Mizpah. And so after that, kind of everybody just went back home. Nothing much was happening after that until we get to chapter 11. So chapter 11, first Samuel. Now Nahash the Ammonite came up and besieged Jabesh Gilead, and all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, make a covenant with us and we will serve you. But Nahash the Ammonite said to them, I'll make it with you on this condition, that I will gouge out the right eye of every one of you. Thus I will make it a reproach on all Israel. Well, there's a deal. Who could refuse a good deal like that? Okay, here's the geography of what's going on here. Here's Jabesh Gilead. It is actually on the east side of the Jordan. And this Ammonite king, Nahash, comes up here and besieges this city. And he says, either yield to me or I'll just wipe you all out. And also, if you will do that, I'm going to gouge out your right eye. Generally speaking, the shield held by a warrior was up in front of his face a little bit, and so the right eye is the thing that would look around that shield. So if you gouged out the right eye, you essentially made the warriors nothing. Okay, so he's making them where they couldn't defend themselves or do anything else for themselves. And so that's his offer. He says, I'll just gouge out your eyes then, and you will serve me. And the elders of Jabesh said to him, well, let us alone for 7 days that we may send messengers throughout the territory of Israel. Then if there's no one to deliver us, we will come out to you. So they say, well, give us a week to think about this. And I guess the Nahash character decides, well, they can't do nothing in a week anyway. Nobody can raise an army in a week, and so, I'll give them their week if that's what they want. And we'll just kind of see how things work out. So they buy themselves that week of time. Then the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and spoke these words in the hearing of the people, and all the people lifted up their voices and wept. So the messengers from there come down to Saul's hometown, right here, Gibeah. Remember, this is the city where those homosexuals and other people raped that concubine to death, and the Levite that she was with cut her up into pieces and mailed her out to the nation, all the different tribes, and that's what started that civil war with Benjamin. Remember that story in Judges? This is his hometown, and this is where that took place. We'll come back to that story in just a moment. So they get the word back now, down here to Saul, who, remember, has been anointed king, that this guy, Hash, or whatever his name is, Nahash, was threatening to kill them and subdue them. So now behold, Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen. So he ain't really set up much of a kingdom yet, has he? He's still working the farm back home. So he comes in from the farm behind a set of oxen, and he said, well, what's the matter with the people that they weep? So they related to him the words of the men of Jabesh. Now this city, if you remember, let me review this storyline for you. You remember when the people murdered this concubine and the Levite she was with cut her up into these pieces here at Gibeah, sent it out to all of the different tribes. They all came together to try to wipe out the people that did that here in Gibeah. And remember, the citizenry of Gibeah wouldn't turn over the offenders. And so there was a civil war where all the other tribes attacked the tribe of Benjamin here and nearly wiped them out. Remember that storyline? Judges 21. So Benjamin was nearly wiped out. They ended up with 600 people. 600 guys was all that was left following that civil war. And so they said, well, how's this tribe going to continue to live? We need some women for these guys. And there weren't any around. They weren't going to give them their daughters. They said, no, we're not going to share our daughters with you guys there in Benjamin, because you supported these murdering dogs that killed that concubine, so you're not going to get our daughters. So they said, I know what to do. Let's go over here and take some daughters from Jabesh Gilead, this city that's now under siege. Remember that? They went over there and got a bunch of women from there, 400 of them, and brought them back down to here. So these two cities, Gibeah and Jabesh Gilead, are sort of sister cities. A lot of the ancestries of these people here came from that city. Their mothers came from that city. That's where they went and got the 400 women and brought them back down here. So there's sort of a, at least loose affiliation between those two cities, because Gibeah sort of survived because of the women that were stolen from Jabesh Gilead. Okay, kind of remember the background there, what went on? Okay, so when Saul hears that Jabesh Gilead is under siege from this Ammonite, Nahash, he ain't happy. Verse 6, the Spirit of God came upon Saul mightily when he heard these words, and he became very angry with what was going on here. And he took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces. I guess this is standard operating procedure if you live in Gibeah. You cut something up into 10, 12 pieces and mail it out to everybody. So he takes the oxen in this case and sends it throughout the territory of Israel by the hand of messengers, saying, whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen. In other words, he says, join up to the army here, guys. I'm recruiting, and if you don't join up, I'm going to do this to your oxen. It's very similar to what happened before when they cut up the concubine. Then the dread of all the people, the dread of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out as one man, and he numbered them in Bezek. Bezek is up here, not on this map, but it's up about into here somewhere, right in through here. So they're gathered up there, and he numbers them as 300,000 men, and of Judah, 30,000. And they said to the messengers who had come, "Thus you shall say to the men of Jabesh-Gilead, tomorrow by the time the sun is hot, you shall have deliverance." So the messengers went and told the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. So the messengers came, got the word to Saul. He raises an army sort of impromptuly, very quickly, and gathers them together there at this city that's about 10 miles away from the one under siege. And it happened the next morning that Saul put the people in three companies, and so he split them up. Can you see the little arrows on that thing? Kind of split them up here into these three different companies, kind of like what Gideon did before. Remember Gideon, when he was judging, did the same sort of thing? So Saul is using that technique here. And they came into the midst of the camp in the morning watch, this would be just about before daylight, and struck down the Ammonites until the heat of the day. And it came about that those who survived were scattered, so that no two of them were left together. This is Saul's finest hour. He is kicking some behinds and taking some names. He's doing a good job. He goes up there as king of Israel, and he whips up on this guy and wipes him out to the point that you can't find two of them together anymore. So then the people said to Samuel, "Who is he that said Saul shall reign over us?" That is, who were these guys that questioned Saul's propriety in reigning over us? Remember that back at the end of chapter 10? Certain worthless men said, "How can this one deliver us?" And they didn't give him any presents. So there were people in the nation that didn't care for Saul and said, "This guy is worthless. He ain't going to be a decent king." So they're saying now after this, "Hey, bring those people out here, the ones that were opposed to Saul, and we'll put them to death." That'll silence that criticism. I guess that's one way of silencing your critics. Just kill them. But Saul said, "Not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished deliverance in Israel." So in this particular incident now, Saul's star is shining quite brightly. He's taken charge. He's led an army. He's delivered his city. He's prevented an injustice against his critics. This guy's looking pretty doggone good. And so as we see going forward what happens to him, it becomes even more tragic when you see that he could have experienced some greatness in his service to the Lord. Instead, he's going to experience humiliation. And it is a tragedy, to be sure. He's a lot like Samson. Great potential, great start, and a big, major flopping bust at the end of his life. But as a result of this nice start, Samuel says, verse 14, "Come, let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there." So the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. They also offered sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. Gilgal is down, there it is actually on this map. They came down here then. After this military success up here, they came down here to this city and sort of recoronated, one too many syllables there, recoronated Saul publicly down there. So that's the third coronation now that he's had, one in private at Ramah, one a little more in public at Mizpah, and now this one totally public at Gilgal. So he's clearly now the recognized leader of Israel, and this battle of Jabesh-Gilead was probably his finest hour. He was doing well and got off to a good start. So chapter 11 is kind of the high point, the watermark in Saul's kingship. But unfortunately, it doesn't remain. Unfortunately, there's a chapter 12 and 13 and 14 and 15. So let's look at those and see how he continues to do. Chapter 12 is Samuel's swan song. This is his farewell speech to the nation. He sees Saul now in a role that, in essence, convinces him that he can now cede his role of theocratic administrator to Saul. So Samuel's going to say basically, "Hey, I'm an old guy. My sons are worthless. I'm not going to put them on you. Saul's going to be your guy going forward. You wanted a king, you got a king. He looks like he can do the job. I'm going to, in essence, hand off my role of theocratic administrator, the man through whom God is working to protect and to deliver us and so on. I'm going to hand that over to Saul." And so that's what he does here in chapter 12. Very similar to the farewell speech by Joshua in Joshua 24. Remember that deal? Choose this day whom you will serve. Me and my family, we're going to serve the Lord. After he rehearsed a lot of the history for the nation, Samuel will do something quite similar here. Chapter 12, Samuel's swan song. So Samuel said to all Israel, "Behold, I have listened to your voice and all that you said to me, and I have appointed a king over you, like you asked. And now here's a king walking before you, Saul, but I'm old and gray." What's wrong with that? I don't see the problem, do you? "And behold, my sons are with you, and I've walked before you from my youth even to this day. Here I am. Bear witness against me before the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or from whose hand have I taken a bribe to blind my eyes with it? I will restore it to you." Samuel says in essence, anybody here that's got something against me, if I've wronged you in any way, bring it up and I will make it right before I go. Have I taken your money? Have I defrauded you in some way? Have I taken bribes from any of you guys? Is there anything out there that you can accuse me of, that you want to accuse me of? Bring it up. And they said, "Well, hey, you haven't defrauded us or oppressed us or taken anything from any man's hand." They recognized and knew the righteous conduct and behavior of Samuel, and they respond to that. And he said to them, "Well, the Lord is witness against you and is anointed as witness this day that you have found nothing in my hand." And they said, "He is witness." He said, "Hey, I'm calling God and Saul to witness that you made that statement. You claimed that I have not taken anything from you or anything of that nature." And they agree to that. So Samuel said to the people, "It is the Lord who appointed Moses and Aaron and who brought your fathers up from the land of Egypt." He's going to kind of recount a little bit of their history now to stress the necessity of obeying God in order for his blessings to fall on the people. And so he uses some of their history to illustrate that. "It was God who brought your fathers up from the land of Egypt. So now take your stand that I may plead with you before the Lord concerning all the righteous acts of the Lord, which he did for you and your fathers. When Jacob went into Egypt and your fathers cried out to the Lord, then the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your fathers out of Egypt and settled them in this place. But they forgot the Lord their God. And so he sold them into the hands of Sisera, captain of the army of Hazor." You remember that character Sisera? He's the one that got the tent peg through his head. Remember that woman at, beg your pardon?
Jail.
Yeah. Remember her? She's the one that when he was sleeping, pinned his head to the ground with a tent peg. That was Sisera, captain of Hazor, and into the hand of the Philistines and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against him. And they cried out to the Lord and said, "We have sinned because we have forsaken the Lord and have served the Baals and the Ashtaroth, and now deliver us from the hands of our enemies and we will serve thee." So they recognize their foolish ways in worshiping these various idols, Baals and the Ashtaroth. But they say now that if the Lord will forgive them, they'll worship him. And the Lord sent Jerubbaal and Bedan and Jephthah and Samuel. I don't know if Bedan, he was apparently a judge that wasn't named in the judges, so I don't know about him, but the other guys were named there. "And these different judges delivered you from the hands of your enemies all around so that you lived in security." He just mentions a few of them. There were at least 12 we know of, maybe a few others, and he just mentioned a few of them here. "So when you saw that Nahash, the king of the sons of Ammon, came against you and said to me, 'No, but a king shall reign over us, although the Lord your God was your king.'" See, their viewpoint all along was, we don't really like that. We don't like God being our king. We want a guy. "Now therefore, here's the king whom you have chosen, whom you've asked for, and behold, the Lord has set a king over you. If you'll fear the Lord and serve him and listen to his voice and not rebel against the command of the Lord, then both you and also the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God. And if you will not listen to the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the command of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers." You remember the operating principle that God established between himself and his people at Mount Sinai when he issued the Mosaic Covenant was obedience brings blessing, disobedience brings judgment. That was the operating principle of the Old Testament era. Obey first and then blessings will follow. Disobey and judgments will follow. That's their operating principle. We live under that operating principle today.
No, that's not the operating principle of the church age. The operating principle of the church age is faith. We live by faith. It's the grace of God that is the governor between him and us, not obedience as it was back here. But here it was, and he reminds them of that. Even now, take your stand and see this great thing which the Lord will do before your eyes. That is, God is going to do something before you now as a reminder of this principle. And so Samuel called to the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. Now the reason, I skipped a verse so you don't know, let's go back to verse 17. Is not the wheat harvest today? The reason that that matters is because it almost never rained during the wheat harvest. So Samuel is going to use a circumstance that is extraordinary or unusual to prove God's involvement in this little covenant thing. He says, I'll call to the Lord that he may send thunder and rain, and then you will know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord by asking for yourselves a king. So in other words, what this little miracle that God is going to work is indeed a sign to them that their request for a king other than God was a mistake on their part. So Samuel called to the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. This is so unusual that it would rain at this time of year, at the wheat harvest, that when it did, they recognized that it was clearly a sign from God to prove his point, to attest to what Samuel was saying. So he did that. He sent that sign, and it rained and thundered, and they recognized that the Lord's hand was in that, and all that Samuel was saying was true. Then all the people said to Samuel, well, pray for your servants to the Lord your God. Sort of a distancing of themselves here, isn't it? So that we may not die, for we have added to all our sins this evil by asking for ourselves a king. They now realize that that was a mistake. They asked for God's forgiveness of it. And Samuel said to the people, well, do not fear. You've committed all this evil, yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. And you must not turn aside, for then you would go after futile things which cannot profit or deliver because they are futile. Did they do a good job of that? Of not turning aside to these false gods around them and all that stuff? No, they stunk up the whole place with that. Ultimately, they got carried off into captivity. Northern 10 tribes by the Assyrians in 712, and the southern 2 tribes by the Babylonians in 605. So no, they didn't do it worth a flip at obeying this promise. For the Lord will not abandon his people on account of his great name. That's the reason God continues to deliver these people, because they go by his name. They represent him. Not because their behavior warrants it. And that's the only reason he kept delivering them, was because of his great name. Because the Lord has been pleased to make you a people for himself. Until ultimately even that was disbanded. And now who is the people for himself? Who has replaced Israel in the role of a nation of priests and so on? Who is that now? That's us. That's the church. We have become, Peter tells us, what they were supposed to be. They failed. We then take on that role as the church. More or less, may far be it for me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you, but I will instruct you in the good and right way. Samuel says, I will continue to pray for you. Don't worry about that. That's my job, and I will continue to do that. Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, both you and your king shall be swept away. So the whole summation of Samuel's comments is the same basic thing in principle that we see back at the establishment of the Mosaic Covenant. Obedience will bring blessings. Disobedience will bring judgment. And if you guys continue to disobey, you and your king that you wanted so badly will be swept away. The Assyrians swept away the northern 10 tribes in 712, and Nebuchadnezzar swept away the southern 2 tribes in 605 BC. So between the Assyrians and the Babylonians, exactly that happened to them. Their kings were swept away, and that brought an end to the kingdom, both for the northern and the southern kings. But the northern was about 100 years sooner than the southern. But they all eventually got swept away. So unfortunately, Samuel's warning was actually experienced by these guys 300 to 400 years later than when he gave it here. So Saul's off to a good start. Samuel recognizes and, in essence, cedes his authority to Saul as the
theocratic administrator of the nation, and things don't look too terribly bad. Until chapter 13. Now, Saul was 40 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 32 years over Israel. There's some problems with verse 1 of chapter 13 and exactly what it says. There's a reference in Acts that Saul reigned for 40 years, and that's the one that I'm going to go by because there's a bunch of... The grammar of verse 1 is choppy and broken, and it's hard to know exactly what's being said. But just if you think of Saul as reigning for 40 years, you'll be okay. So, he chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel, of which 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash, in the hill country of Bethel, while 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah of Benjamin. But he sent away the rest of the people, each to his tent. So he only has an army now of 3,000 people. He's got 2,000 of them with him at this place called Michmash, right here. And a new character introduced to us named Jonathan, who is Saul's son, has the other 1,000 at Gibeah, which is right here. So Saul's got 2,000 here. Jonathan's got 1,000 of them here. This thing ain't got a legend on it, but it ain't very far away, a few miles at most. Who's this guy Jonathan? Where'd he come from? That's Saul's son. In order to be a military leader and to be involved in military activities, he has to be over 20 years old. So Jonathan, when we first see him, is at least 20, if not older. Later on, he's going to develop the relationship with David that is a very, very strong friendship, but the age differential is quite odd. This guy's old enough to be David's father, which we'll talk about more later. But Jonathan, now his son, comes into the picture. And probably one of the most endearing, the most impressive figures in this whole storyline, including David, is this guy Jonathan. This guy is impressive, very impressive. So he's got 1,000 troops there at Gibeah, and his father, Saul's got 2,000 up at Michmash, and everybody else is at home in their tents cooking barbecue. So Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was at Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. Now Jonathan just kind of steps right out into the picture and starts to do some things. Oh, this map is probably about as good as anything. There's a Philistine garrison right around here somewhere. What they would do is kind of like we used to do in the frontier days, U.S. cavalry and military would put forts around different places out in the Indian territories and so on, from which they would kind of keep tabs on things, and they'd have some people there to put down uprisings and stuff like that. That's what the Philistines have here. They've got a garrison over here in this territory, and it's not too far from where Jonathan is at Gibeah. So he goes over there and wipes that thing out. Jonathan did. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And all Israel heard the news that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become odious to the Philistines. The people were then summoned to Saul at Gilgal. So Saul kind of, in essence, takes credit for his son's victory, and he gathers a bunch of troops together then over here at Gilgal, which was right here. So we're longing through here is where these activities are going on. He gathers a bunch of troops right over there. All these cities are right there close by in the Benjamin territories anyway, but you can kind of see a little bit of difference there. Now the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel. 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and the people like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance. And they came up and camped in Michmash east of Beth-Aven. So the Philistines now get together a bunch of their troops after Jonathan wipes out one of their garrisons, and they've accumulated a bunch of people here, and Saul's over here with his assortment of people. And when the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, that's because the other guys have a whole lot more people and chariots and so on than they do, for the people were hard-pressed, that the people hid themselves in caves and thickets and cliffs and in cellars and in pits. Some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead, but as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him, trembling. So what's happened here now is that Saul over here, when he sees he's greatly outnumbered and so on by the Philistines, some of his people start to desert him. They start hiding in caves and splitting and going away. Some of them even crossed over into the east side of the Jordan there. And so his military stature is kind of eroding away real quick-like before the Philistine onslaught there. People deserting him, hiding in caves, and this kind of thing. Now, he waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel. What is that? What is the appointed time set by Samuel? Well, remember back in chapter 10, verse 8, when he first anointed Saul at Ramah, he said, "You shall go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I will come down to you and offer burnt offerings and sacrifice peace offerings. You shall wait 7 days until I come to you and show you what you should do." So Samuel has told Saul ahead of time that the day would come at Gilgal when there would be a conflict, and Saul was to wait for Samuel for 7 days. Samuel would come down and offer the sacrifices to God in an appeal for God's help and so on. And Saul was to wait for him those 7 days. That's what's happening here now. This prophecy by Samuel is now coming to pass. So Saul waited 7 days according to the appointed time by Samuel, chapter 10, verse 8. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal. And the people were scattering from him. His troops are abandoning him at a rapid pace, and Samuel didn't get there yet. And it came about as soon as he finished offering, verse 9. So Saul said, "Bring me the burnt offerings and the peace offerings." And he offered the burnt offering. Saul steps into the role of Samuel, of God's priest function there, and offers these sacrifices himself. That was the beginning of the end of Saul. That disobedient act starts a snowball rolling downhill that doesn't stop until it's big enough to crush him, and does. So he takes on a role that is not his and doesn't wait for Samuel. Verse 10, it came about as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and greet him, and Samuel said to him, "What have you done?" In other words, he knew that Saul had disobeyed God, stepped into a role that was not his, and created a bad problem for himself. And Saul says in response that, "Well, because I saw that the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the appointed days, and that the Philistines were assembling at Mishmash, therefore I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not asked for the favor of the Lord, so I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." His defense of himself kind of reminds me of Adam in the garden, when he sinned, he says, "God, that woman that you gave me caused me to slip up here. It's either your fault or her fault. I don't really care who, but it ain't mine." And that's essentially what Saul is saying here. "Samuel, you didn't get here in time. It's your fault. And all these bad guys are lining up against me here, and so I had no choice. I forced myself to take a role that wasn't mine and to disobey God because you didn't get here in time. It's your fault, Samuel." But that argument is not going to win the day. Samuel said to Saul, "You have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you," chapter 10, verse 8, "for now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever." You would have been the dynasty reigning over this nation forever if you had obeyed God, Saul. "But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." What could have been an eternal kingdom of Saul and his line of descent is now going to get flushed. He's going down a drain, and God is going to pick someone else to replace him. Samuel doesn't name that someone yet. Who do you think it is? He just knows that this act of disobedience has now disqualified him, and his dynasty is going to begin and end with him. He's not going to have any heir to the throne of Israel. And so what began so nicely there in chapter 11, what looked impressive and potentially great for him, has been lost in chapter 13. Then Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people who were with him, about 600 men. So he's got like 600 guys to go against these 30,000 Philistines. And Saul and his son Jonathan and the people who were present with him were staying at Geba of Benjamin while the Philistines camped at Mishmash. And the raiders came from the camp of the Philistines in three companies, one company toward Ophrah, toward the land of Sheol, another company turned toward Beth Horon, and another company turned toward the border which overlooks the valley of Zeboim toward the wilderness. In other words, the Philistines came in and they split up their guys into three camps too. Sent one group out after these guys, one group this way, and one group that way. So all Israel went down to the Philistines, each to sharpen his plowshares, his mattock, his axe, and his hoe. What in the world is going on here? Oh, I skipped a verse. Verse 19, no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make swords or spears. The Philistines monopolized metalwork, and so the Israelis, they couldn't go off and make their own spears and their own swords and all that stuff. They are fighting with farm implements. So they have to go into the Philistine territories where there are blacksmiths who can sharpen these things and use them as weapons. And so the Philistines, verse 21, they charged them an arm and a leg. The charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshares and the mattocks, the forks, the axes to fix the hose. And it came about on the day of battle that neither sword nor spear was found in the hands of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan. But they were found with Saul and Jonathan. That is, Saul and Jonathan had swords that they'd gotten their hands on somewhere. But the army in general, they're fighting with pitchforks and hoes and sickles and, you know, anything you could make a weapon out of, but not a good sword or spear or something like that. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass at Michmash. So they're ready for the battle. The Israelis have paid through the nose to try to get what they can get their hands on, sharpened and readied for battle as best they could. And Saul has been given the news that his kingship is history. That would be a little demotivating just before a life-threatening battle, wouldn't it? But that's what he's gotten. And we've seen an unfortunate, significant downturn in the status of Saul's kingship here in chapter 13. Since you are pressing me heavily for a piece of cake, I'll shut up. Any questions about what we've seen here this morning? A good start, an optimistic, encouraging start for the kingship of Saul. Took the bull by the horns, went up there to Jabesh Gilead, stomped on that Ammonite real good like. He looked like that was a good choice. But when the next battle came around, he failed miserably. And God has disqualified him, and he's on his way out. Now, he doesn't know yet who it is, and it's not going to be immediate. He's going to reign for 40 years, so this is going to go on for a while. But he is essentially done at this point in time. It's just a kind of a matter of time now until his decline is sort of, well, it will be culminated with his death. So what was a good start because of his disobedience to God will be a fast end, unfortunately. Questions or comments about anything we saw there? What's that?
Why did they fight all the time?
Well, their enemies didn't give them much choice. The Philistines, the Ammonites, and all these other guys are always trying to take over their territory and stuff like that. And so they just kind of had to fight to stay alive, I think.
How did Saul raise so many men back in chapter 11 or 12 when there weren't any communications?
I guess those messengers did a good job of giving the right impression. When he cut that oxen up and said, this is going to be your oxen, if you don't get over here with some weapons, they responded quite quickly, apparently.
But he got the word out.
Yeah, they did. They got them out fast.
Did they have weapons for that first battle?
Apparently they had the same sort of stuff. That is, whatever you could get your hands on. They later get some, but they right now the Philistines monopolize that metalworking and the blacksmithing that went along with it to where they had the good stuff and the Israelis had whatever they get their hands on. You know, a sharp stick, I guess, would make a decent weapon. So it wasn't very, very well balanced, was it? Anything else?